For those few of you who haven't come before to any of the genetic sessions, I'm Mark Marenko, and I teach at Pacific University, which is not Pacific Lutheran University. Pacific University, which is just west of Portland, in Oregon. And I've been there since 1988. Did the biomedical ethics there for a number of years, and basically I noticed every year that I did this course that the section on genetics seemed to get a little bit larger and a little bit larger until pretty soon it was half the course, and I realized that something was going on here that needed to be addressed more fully. And that was sort of the beginning of my interest in doing the kinds of things that we're going to be doing today. The NIH in 1989 began a project called the Human Genome Project, and the attempt was to sequence the entire human genome. And that turned out to be, it was one of the few government projects that ended up being done ahead of time and under budget. They ended up being able to do this fairly quickly, and after that, then all a lot of effort's been put into then, okay, what do we do with this map? What do we do with the information we have? Turned out that there were far fewer genes that were needed to create what the biologists call the form and function of being a human being. There turns out to be around 30,000 of them. And these genes lie along things called chromosomes. Again, I'm just sort of quickly recapitulating a little bit of the science for those who weren't here. And these genes are distinct sequences on this strand of DNA that code, that create recipes, in a sense, for specific proteins that are then used by the body for all of our various functions that we have in our body. Sometimes things can go wrong in a sequence of DNA where one of the four letters is mutated into another one or is just damaged in some way that ends up producing a codon, which is an amino, a codon that then produces an amino acid that's not correct and ends up with a misshapen protein that can cause trouble for us. Sometimes really big trouble. For example, cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs disease or Huntington's. We're going to do a quick case here in a minute on Huntington's disease. Yesterday we talked a little bit about embryos, and we almost got diverted into a theological discussion of something called ensoulment, the idea which comes in a sense from how do we account for that dimension of being a human being that we think of as being our essential self, or to be a person. What does it mean to be a person? A person such that, in the morally relevant sense, right, that it would be a crime to do bad things to it, to injure it or to kill it or something. When does this happen? You know, when does this happen? And I taught abortion classes on abortion now, again, since 1990, and I'm telling you, I'll have guest lecturers come into my usually, Oregon Right to Life and NARAL or something come in and try and get their best people to come in. And neither of them seem to make much sense at all in terms of the context of moral reasoning that was being taught in my courses. And usually after they would go, I would need to make their case more for them to even get to the point where we could have, a debate, a clear debate about what's going on. And obviously, as you get closer to the state, the position of birth, the time of birth, the whole argument about choice, freedom of choice, becomes more complicated the further. And Roe v. Wade took account of this fact, too. The closer you get to the third trimester and so on, it becomes difficult to understand what the difference between a late-term abortion and infanticide might be. If you're looking at some inherent or intrinsic quality in the fetus itself, right? This is the problem. What's the difference between being inside and outside the womb? So, but then on the other hand, you know, we get back way back to this. This is a blastomere, by the way, you know, an early stage sort of embryo. And then you may have some difficulties being able to identify with this as a human being in the morally relevant sense, this thing that we're looking at right here. And of course, the Oregon Pro Right to Life movement, they come in, the first thing she does is she takes out of her bag a little, you know, model of a fetus, you know, right? You know, and says, you don't want to kill this, do you? You know, this is obviously a human being, you don't want to kill it, so on and so forth. Not, you know, talking, you know, showing that she thinks the same thing is true of that fetus model for this as well, right? And so you have this problem with this whole debate. But I was asked yesterday a little bit, again, why I don't want to have the abortion debate today, or the discussion today about abortion. But I was asked a couple of times, hey, Soren, welcome back. You can come in if you want, or you can stay up. Okay. A couple people asked to say a little bit more about the blastomere and what I was saying about genetic testing at this level, how you do the pre-implantation testing, and things that can happen right at this stage. And one thing that is remarkable about this thing here, one thing that's remarkable about it, is that say you have 8 cells. And what you can do is you go in with a little pipette and get in there, and you can actually pull one of these cells out, and the embryo is going to be just fine. You aren't going to injure, do any damage to the embryo by pulling one of these cells out. So the idea then is you let it divide up to around 8 cells, you pull one of those cells out, you do genetic testing using the DNA from this cell, right? You now have a complete, accurate genetic profile of the embryo that you then can use to implant or not to implant based on information that you get about the embryo from the test that you do. Right? Yeah.
Does that have all of the information that the adult will ultimately have?
Yes, everything's there. Everything's there.
Now, somehow or another, cells, I don't know if the right word is, differentiate themselves to become hair and fingernails and eyes and all that.
Ah, see, there's the problem. At about 2 weeks, as you move out in the process, there is something that takes place that some bioethicists want to make a big deal about, and maybe you do too, I don't know. Called streak, where a streaking occurs.
So I'm really asking at that point, is the DNA different than it is here?
The DNA is not different. What's happening to the DNA, though, apparently it's something like this. At some point, beginning around 2 weeks, you begin the process of differentiation. And what that looks like, from what I've been told, is something like this, that this long strand of DNA, which is in every cell of our bodies, begins to fold over on itself in a particular characteristic way, controlled perhaps by regulatory genes, on what was called the junk DNA, folds over on itself so that only certain proteins are expressed. Only certain proteins are expressed and others are suppressed. That's what differentiation means. So eventually you end up, yes, with the whole strand of DNA in the nucleus of the cell, but only producing that chemical that we use in our mouths and our saliva when we begin to eat to digest our food. Nothing else is there. It doesn't produce muscle cells, anything else. It's all it produces is the protein to do that.
Yeah, yeah. The protein's not part of the DNA. It's what the DNA produces.
Yes, that's right. Yep. Yeah, the DNA creates a copy that's then used as a recipe to make the amino acids, which in turn make the protein. Okay. So, but now, back to the problem here that can arise. Is that you pull this one cell out. There, my son came running up to me and I was asked, is it difficult, you know, being a parent, doing ethics, you know, is it more difficult and usually if I have a presentation like this, I try to deconstruct what it means to do what I do for a living. I'm a philosopher interested in ethics, but there's nothing about being a philosopher interested in ethics that translates into anything remotely like moral expertise or something of that sort. My batting average is pretty much the same as yours. Sometimes you hit the ball, sometimes you don't. And if you're lucky, you know how what to do when you miss the ball, right? From an ethics point of view. Where were we?
You were about to say that there was some kind
of thing
that happens in 2 weeks that people are...
Oh, right. What happens is, it's called streaking, and what happens is that it seems as though this thing at that stage takes on a kind of polarity. That is to say, where you'll know where the head's going to be and the feet are going to be. And things begin shaping around that. And cells begin differentiating according to the function that's required for that part of the body. And for some bioethicists, this is morally significant. I'm not sure exactly why that would be myself, but for some, this is an important moment, which then would allow for, obviously, would be convenient, because then it would allow for all kinds of research that could then be done from an, ethically be done prior to that point of the streaking. But, I mean, just to be, if you're pro life type person, meaning that you believe that you have a person in the morally relevant sense here, such that to kill it would be the moral equivalent of killing a you or a me in the room here, then there's all kinds of puzzles and that you kind of got to work with. One is, if you do take this cell out, it's what's called totipotent cell. It is, in effect, another embryo that you've just created. You've just now created a genetic twin of this embryo.
Because it would divide and become.
Because it would divide and eventually could be implanted as well as this. There's no real moral distinction between one of these cells and eight of them all combined. In terms of what's going to happen in either case, it's the same thing. One of them you're deciding to use for testing, another you're deciding to implant or not implant, based on the information you get from that test.
Are they inside something there?
Pardon?
Are they encased in something?
Well, this is just the growing, the sac within which the cells are dividing. Okay. Don, do you have a question?
Is the present state of science that when you take one out and you discover there's some serious defect, the only option then is to abort it? Because science isn't yet good enough to fix it, is that true?
Oh yeah. Fixing stuff at this point is just non—it's not on the map right now. Being able to actually fix some genetic.
But people anticipate it.
People anticipate
it. Can I ask? I've been out of science for a few years. Is it possible to take a single cell out of a blastomere in vivo, or is this only done with the embryo
outside the body. Thanks to
so
Louise
Brown.
So
abortion isn't an issue. If there's something wrong, the question is, do you implant the embryo or not?
Right, but if you carry through the logic of the pro-choice or the pro-life type position, where the embryo is, the implantation is not a morally significant event.
Right.
What's the difference between an embryo that's implanted and one that's not? Well, it hasn't implanted yet. It hasn't attached itself to the wall of the uterus. So that's not a morally significant event. So that's one problem. Well, also this is an interesting kind of metaphysical puzzle in that every one of these cells is a potential human being. By not choosing to divide them, right, now that we have the knowledge and the power, but choosing not to pull them out and dividing, we are certainly, in that sense, cutting off a possible life that could have been lived had we pulled them out, let them divide and implant them. Every conception has within it the potential for an indefinite number of live births.
But there would be an indefinite number of identical live births.
Yeah, in this case, they'd all be identical. They've got up to something like 100 cows that are genetically identical, to produce certain kinds of proteins and so on. So it's possible that would be one way of doing it.
You mentioned previously about two merging into one. Is this the stage at which
I did not plant him. Okay. So, yeah, another then a puzzle that was asked about to be, you know, explained again a little bit more was, did you want to ask a question first?
I wanted to follow up a little bit on, you said each one of these cells could potentially lead to another, if you implant it to another fetus and another
well, person. Implant it in a, yeah, in a in an available uterus.
Oh. right. Oh, okay. But isn't that true for you? I mean, we can take a cell from you, and we can clone you.
Well, we're going to get to that in a minute. So this is my second plant.
But that's the same thing, isn't it?
It's similar. It's okay. Similar. I'll explain why in a minute. Okay. So splitting and fusing then, and then people understand splitting for the most part. That is to say, cloning's been going on for centuries, right? I mean, every once in a while there's a mistake that's made somehow, and the thing separates into two on its own, and you have identical twins, right? The one that most people still don't understand is that does happen in nature is fusion, where you have two pre-embryos here, blastomeres, that are actually from two separate inseminations, right, which would be fraternal twins, they would call them, something like that, right? So that nevertheless, somehow they fuse into one embryo, and you wind up then with a human being, and maybe some of you in this room are from fused embryos, we don't know. And they only discovered this accidentally through doing genetic testing and realizing that they found someone where in one part of their body they had one genetic profile, another part of their body they had another. And they finally did enough research on this to realize that embryos can fuse.
And you were calling these blastomeres, and now we're calling them embryos.
Pre-embryos. These terms are all in flux, I find. I find different books describe using terms to describe. This is you might call it then the embryo at the eight cell division stage. Pre-implantation. So anyway, they fuse, and then there you've got another puzzle to ramp around. Especially if you know the idea is that at conception, at that moment of conception where you have that first cell that then divides, you think of this as the moment in which a soul somehow infuses into that cell. So that soul can divide then, or you can have two of them and they can combine. Certainly then in that case we don't mean by soul person. We don't have two persons in one body or you know separating. Maybe we will get to the Trinity discussion here somehow anyway. Person. So anyway, then now you're talking about something else called nuclear transfer cloning, somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. And I'll just go real quickly through this. This is what Ian Wilmot did with the sheep Dolly in 1996, right? And this was again an accident. What they did was somebody forgot to feed the cells in the petri dishes, and the big thing was that, you know, I told you how the DNA strand folds over on itself and it does all these things to differentiate and only do one thing. Well, the trick was that you have all that information there, but how would you get that strand back into a state that you could then duplicate it? Right? How would you get it back to an undifferentiated state? Well, it turns out the way to do that is you don't feed the thing. You just keep it starving and so on. It begins to unfold and relax. And at some point, they were successful then of denucleating an egg, right? In other words, getting the DNA out of an egg, the gamete here, and then inserting a substitute nucleus inside this egg, right? Then they do the Frankenstein thing and actually give it some jolts of electricity, which they actually do to jolt electricity, and you end up with this thing dividing. And look, it's a female and or a male. In this process, men are not needed at all in any part of the reproductive process. There's no need for men at all. That then is creates the clonal zygote and a clonal embryo, which then can be implanted and brought to birth, and that's what happened in 1996. The first mammal that was cloned through somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning. So what your here point was is that I told you we had trillions of cells in our body, and again, you know, these are kind of metaphysical puzzles you can play with or not. But any cell in your body, then, what he's saying, is theoretically, under the most advanced and optimistic view of science here, theoretically is capable of producing another human being. You know, basically a body that would be your identical twin. So if you did this with you, your son would also be your identical twin brother. He'd also be your son, if you were a man. So that's what I'm looking at, James.
And you introduced another term, zygote.
Zygote. Yeah, sort of. Sometimes I think zygote is used to describe this, whatever you want to call this thing, prior to implantation. Sometimes embryo is used only after implantation. But as I say, I see different people using terms different ways, so.
Could I clarify one thing that you've got on the chart, but I don't think you really mentioned? The egg cell on top is a female egg cell, has only one set of chromosomes.
Right, 23, right.
The somatic cell on the bottom has two sets of chromosomes.
Right.
Like a fertilized egg cell.
Right.
So you're taking out the infertile nucleus on an egg cell and replacing it with a nucleus that has a full complement
46.
Of chromosomes.
Right, basically the same set from which the whatever the critter is that you've taken it out.
And in some senses, once you have a fertilized cell with two sets of chromosomes, that's a zygote.
Yeah, okay. And you need to make it living.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You need the electricity to make it work there. So let's see. Okay, yeah. So this allows then for genetic testing, and this is just a greatly large photograph then of being able to actually go into a cell and pull these things out. It's really quite remarkable to be able to do.
What size
now,
is that?
I don't know what size that is. Very small.
I mean, I can't imagine something small enough to pierce into it.
I know. It's just stunning.
Well, they basically draw down a glass fiber, and you can draw that to extremely small.
Yeah. It's really amazing.
But it has to be
hollow. Well,
it is hollow, and it remains hollow as you draw it down.
So just to prepare for the case study here, then, a couple of things. I just want you to understand that the whole idea of selection, imposing our will on the selection processes to produce a different social result goes way back. And here's just, Plato was playing with this idea in the Republic. So, and here was his, this image of a world in which the best men must have intercourse with the best women. I don't know if you need to tell the best men that they must do this, but the best men, the best men must have intercourse with the best women as frequently as possible. And the opposite is true of the very inferior, and that the children of good parents they will take to a rearing pen in the care of nurses living apart in a certain section of the city. The children of inferior parents or any child of the others born defective, they will hide as is fitting in a secret and unknown place. Now, this isn't Plato's vision, or this isn't his idea or belief. It's simply he was throwing out a picture of a world in which this was projected out to be a way of doing some fairly simple. They understood that something about inheritance here, right? Vague as it is.
Well, we do it when we breed, raise horses, or...
yeah, and Mendel with his peas, right? So, all of these things. So I thought what I'd do is real quickly here, just the biotechnology timeline. I haven't done this before yet. Sumerian, 1750, understood about beer, right?
For the first time. Something to do with it.
500 BCE, Chinese used moldy soybean curd as an antibiotic to treat boils. Plato writes a Republic, which I just shared with you. Microscope invented 1663. By the way, it's interesting that you could see with the evolution of the microscope how the philosophy that's associated with what we were just talking about in terms of the meaning of the embryo gets projected into the microscope, because in some of the drawings you see a little homunculus there, just like this little tiny baby that's inside the sperm just waiting to be put in the right place so it could start growing, right? This idea of that you were always who you were, even to that stage of the sperm. Proteins discovered, 1830, so it's a long time ago. Bacterium discovered. Mendel discovers that traits are transmitted via discrete independent units, later called genes, and the first Mendelian law has to do with recessive. Remember what we talked about yesterday, what recessive means? The law of recessive inheritance. Francis Galton writes hereditary genius, coins the term eugenics. In other words, taking of the science, using one's imagination, and projecting it out into what could be done with that science to further social goods or social aims. Chromosomes are discovered, 1879. They're big enough that we're able to discover them. Salamander embryo split, each grew to adulthood, beginning to understand the whole thing about being able to have genetic twins through splitting. The term genetics is coined by William Bateson, biologist. Aldous Huxley, Brave New World, 1932. That's interesting, because we saw the film clip from The Thin Man, which was in the mid-30s, you know, and Aldous Huxley is writing it. Discovery that genetic information is carried via DNA. DNA itself has been around for a long time. That what it is that Crick and Watson discovered was the structure of DNA, and everything came together with that discovery. First successful IVF, in vitro fertilization using bulls. Watson and Crick discover structured DNA year after I was born, 53. Frog cloned using nucleus, a differentiated cell, 62. Term clone is coined by Haldane. Genetic code is broken. Discovery of codon amino acid correlations, telling you that you have those three bases that then correlate with an amino acid, so you end up having that connection between the three bases and the specific amino acids was discovered in 66. First successful combining of DNA from two different organisms. NIH forms advisory committee to oversee recombinant genetic research. A book about, first novel about cloning, 1978. Baby Louise, looks like most of you are old enough to even remember this. Boy, what a headline that was with the first, and after all, well, this is that, you know, that the conception takes place outside the body, and in the petri dish is put back in the body. Landmark patent case having to do with patents, and again, we're not going to be talking about genetic patents and so on, but it's a real morass. First transgenic animals created, mice in 1981. First transgenic pig created, which produced human growth factor.
What's transgenic?
Transgenic means like the chimera being able to have DNA sequences from two distinct species combined.
Different species.
Combined, yeah. Genetic fingerprinting enters the courtroom first time, 1985. The first time it really sinks into our consciousness, I think, was the O.J. Simpson trial. You couldn't get through a day without hearing about genetic information going on. 1985, genetic markers for kidney disease and cystic fibrosis. So even back then, before the Human Genome Project, you ended up scientists began finding markers, genetic markers, for specific kinds of diseases. Launches Human Genome Project, 1989-90. 91st-gen transgenic cow, which produces proteins for baby formula. Development of technique for testing embryos in vitro. This is an interesting one. NIH withdraws funding from David Wasserman's conference on genetics and crime. They had approved a project to explore the genetic basis for crime, for behavior, for violence and so on, and it produced such an uproar that the NIH quietly pulled the money back and said, we don't really want you to do this. They later reinstated this program, but it was a big deal. First human embryos cloned using blastomere separation, so the same thing they did with the salamander, they did with human embryos in 19, 1993. And again, these were embryos that were destined for destruction because of the kind of testing that Don was mentioning before. They weren't going to be implanted, so they did this with them, and they let them go to a certain stage, and then they destroyed them. Dean Hammer, got to meet him out at Dartmouth for a couple of weeks to discover evidence for genetic correlation with homosexuality. Holland Brothers case, X chromosome implicated in the gene for violence. First whole genetically altered food, again, first breast cancer gene discovered. I'm sorry. You'd think up here you wouldn't have to tell people to turn off their cell phones. Then Dolly's born in 1996. President Clinton proposes a 5-year ban on cloning, announces his intention to clone. 19 European nations, 1998, signed ban on cloning. First draft of the human genome completed in 2000. President Bush bans use of all but a few stem cell lines in research. Remember that.
Soon the ban on cloning was banned on human cloning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then in 2004, there was this big story about 30 cloned human embryos. Turned out to be completely false. So let's do a couple of cases then based on this now, and we can then forget the technology and talk about the case real quick here.
I have one question real quick. Most of these genetic markers it's not a positive genetic marker. Like, you have these genetic markers, you definitely have this disease. Most are a percentage chance, right?
Yeah, but that's a function of our knowledge of how genes interact with each other to produce complex interactions between proteins and things. So, our ability to predict becomes more. So, okay, here's an example. Okay, breast cancer. While we're going through this, and men get breast cancer too, by the way. But you end up in this discussion we're having, all of us, there's mutations going on in our body. Right? One of them may be on that gene. You might call that a lightning strike. Now, what if that turns out to be on a gamete? If the mutation is on a gamete, that's then going to be passed on and will be a lightning strike on every cell in your body of your child.
Yeah.
It's going to be in their cells. So that's the first lightning strike. And you may not get cancer at all, but you're much more likely to get cancer. Because all it takes is it would be another strike, and you're now in a position of being at really high risk for cancer. So that seems to be the current theory. Is you have sort of the three strikes and you're out kind of a theory that it has to do with strikes. So
it's still an issue of risk and risk management, risk profiles.
That's right. Yeah. And the selective of non-implantation based on probabilities is a part of the moral discussion, the ethics discussion. You know, whether that's sufficient.
An individual statistic doesn't apply.
That's
to
right.
An individual.
That's right. Exactly right. So, and when I was in Britain in 2004 on sabbatical up in Edinburgh, there were a woman. They were doing pre-implantation genetic screening on her for colon cancer. And she didn't want to have implanted in, one that had predisposition to colon cancer. But the probability of getting colon cancer with the allele didn't seem to rise high enough to the level for many people to warrant this kind of intervention. And there was, again, outcry in the newspapers, and people who had this disease, who had survived the cancer or were predisposed and didn't have the cancer were all in an uproar about the thing. All right, but one of the things we can do, we can test fetal fetuses for various things. And one of the things that's very distinct, and it's 100%, is Huntington's disease. So here's a case. This is a case that came out of a friend of ours in the Kaiser Clinic down in Oregon. So you're a genetic counselor working for a private genetic testing clinic. So we're changing some of the details. Mary has an appointment, made an appointment and begins the interview by stating she's 7 weeks pregnant. She would like personal prenatal testing to determine whether her fetus has the genetic allele for Huntington's disease on chromosome 4, you see there. Mary continues the interview by saying that she is contemplating marriage to Steve, who is the man she conceived with. Earlier in their relationship, Steve told Mary that there is a history of Huntington's disease in his family, but he is emphatic about not wanting to be tested. They have had many arguments about this. Mary decided to conceive with Steve and have the fetus tested as a way of finding out about Steve's genetic status for Huntington's disease.
These people should not get married. Regardless.
Do you mean that?
Yeah. Mm.
That's up to them.
If they can't communicate any better than that.
Let's do the questions and see how it complicates it all. Would you agree to arrange testing for Mary under these circumstances? In this case, by the way, the genetic counselor did not. She felt like she just, once she understood the purpose or the motives for the test, she used those as a basis for denying her services. Should Steve be informed that Mary has had such a test in the event you choose to allow her fetus to be screened? But by the way, you might get to the point, this is relevant to our churches, you might get to the point where you think, look, you know, we're not going to be able to do a lot of legislation regulating at the legal level for these kinds of scenarios. But many people are involved and look to church bodies for guidance in precisely these kinds of circumstances. And how wonderful would it be? I think it would be wonderful. It would be a good thing for our churches to be able to, to be able to have pastoral conferences that go into a lot of the details of these things that are coming up, to be able to have some place from which to stand to be able to address these kinds of questions, right? That short of legal, regulatory kinds of things. So these are important cases. Should Steve be able to prevent such prenatal testing, since in a sense to test the fetus is to test him? If this is the case, should we require the consent of whole families when anyone within the family wants to be screened or tested? Are the motives of Mary morally relevant in this case?
Yeah.
Sounds like it, probably so. You know, is all genetic testing contrary to what it means to be a person of faith? Like I told you about the Christian scientists, you know, they don't want any of their people to have, at least according to the leadership in Portland we talked to, they don't want them to even contemplate a genetic test, because the mere contemplation of taking the test can produce the negative effects that they're worried about testing for. So, is all genetic testing contrary to what it means to be a person of faith? Okay, so again,
problem is Mary never should have told the counselor her intentions and all. Most of this would be moot.
Yeah.
I imagine by should there, you don't mean a moral should.
Yeah.
Right. Just to check again, Huntington's disease, you die when you're 30. What's the?
Depends on the number of repeating three A's in this case. If you once you get up to around 40, you've got the disease, and all of us have repeats here. But once you get up to around 40, that's it. You're going to have Huntington's, and if you have a lot of them, you'll get it earlier. If you have just a few, you'll get it later. Will you get it? Yes, 100%, you will get it. You will die from it. It will be very, very painful. I mean, you might be hit by a truck or something. I mean, if you get the disease and controlling for everything else, you're going to die from it. Yeah. So, and usually in 40s and 50s is when the onset of the actual disease
is. Huntington's disease is a muscular skeletal disease, or?
No, it produces some kinds of abundance of this protein or something that affects the brain, as far as from what I understand. You may be thinking of ALS, motor neuron disease.
So what are the symptoms of it, of Huntington?
Oh, gosh, I told a story last week, you know, when we were at Dartmouth, there was a story in Florida of a woman who had married someone who didn't know. Maybe this story was where the woman married someone who didn't want to be tested for Huntington's, had Huntington's. She took care of him through the disease, and he died a terrible death. Her first son came down with symptoms, took care of him as well until he died. Her second son became symptomatic, went into hospital, and she went in and shot him. Killed him.
Shot him. Because she didn't want to have to do it a third time.
She didn't want him to go through it either. So it's a very, very awful disease. So, and usually doesn't show up till after you've had kids.
Yeah.
So, anyway, so, again, I'm not going to have us break up into groups, but maybe we could just discuss this a little bit. How would you respond to a situation like this? Yeah.
Well, I think it's fair of Mary to ask, do you think you, I mean, I suppose you could look at Steve and say, you know, if you've got Huntington, I don't think I'm interested in this relationship. And then Steve has the question, well, if you're not interested in me because maybe I'm going to be a burden in 10 years, then maybe you're not interested in me. But for him to refuse, and is he refusing to see if she loves him anyway? You know, I mean, this seems like a, if I were Mary, I would just either say, okay, you're not going to get tested, I'm not going to take that chance. It seems like a lot of trouble to go through. Is she going to have the kid? Or is she just pregnant so she can get the test
done
and then abort
it?
If
the test turned out positive, she'd abort the child and dump Steve, right?
Well, maybe she'd abort the child anyway. Maybe she doesn't want a child, she just wants to know whether he's going to get Huntington's. So maybe her intent is never to have a child in this particular scenario. If it's just her backdoor way of finding out and she has no intention of keeping this child anyway.
Well, in this case, all we know is that she's trying to decide whether to go through with this marriage based on her knowledge of what Huntington's would mean for her future.
Yeah. And at this point, he's not married to her, so she's looking at being a single mother. She has a right to know if this child is going to have Huntington's.
This is the problem, is that normally, you know, barring any other liberty-limiting principles we say here, you know, normally we would not inquire into her reasons.
Or
we were saying that it was a mistake in wanting to have her fetus tested. What are we doing? The only reason this all comes up is because of this genetic test. All of the stuff we're talking about creates new scenarios that we hadn't imagined when we stood up and said women have these rights and we need to, all of a sudden it's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Because it's not just about her. It's about a fetus who will become a person, and it's about Steve.
It's the curse of evolution that has allowed us to develop to a level where we can understand this level of development in our life.
Chickens don't have these problems.
Did you get that
well,
on the
doesn't
tape? Chickens don't, okay.
I guess for me, I wouldn't do it because the whole thing is deceitful and I just don't want to play a part in it.
No, but why? So I think many of us would feel some reservation. What I'm trying to do is get us to identify why it is that we would resist participating in this scenario. And then the second question is, since this is largely a community of theologically oriented people, and do our theological traditions have something to say about this kind of scenario? I mean, if you just put it in ethics terms, what do you have conflict here? You know, well, one is the normal kind of good that would come from a potential mother wanting to test, you know, her own fetus, right? And the other is very simple, confidentiality, you know. We don't normally force people to give us information unless they're willing to do so, particularly genetic information.
But
and she's explicitly said the reason she's doing this is to get information about a third party. Third party's not involved. So we have, you know, just put in ethics terms, that's kind of the debate you've got going here.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, in a way, maybe you shouldn't have told us that the genetic counselor, what decision that genetic counselor reached. But surely she didn't get pregnant just to get information. She could have got it off the
cigarette or
a glass of water, couldn't she?
No.
Aren't there easier ways to get somebody's DNA than to get pregnant by them?
I don't know.
Analyzed.
I don't know if we want to. So I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
No, but surely she did in this case get pregnant to get information about Steve.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know if.
You see, you could if she went to Kaiser to
to get free genetic counseling. Just getting some DNA from Steve.
She'd have to put out some money.
She'd have to.
Yeah, $200.
No. Not at the time of this case.
That might be the issue.
Yeah, now, you know, for about $399.99, you know, you can get pretty much a genetic profiling done for your.
But am I right that you don't need to get pregnant to get the information? You could just get out a glass of water.
Yeah, if you had the resource. Okay. Well, I don't know about a glass of water, but you could get, yeah, you could a hair or eyelash or something. Yeah. But is that morally relevant? I mean, I'm trying to get to what the morally relevant and theologically relevant
the
in this case.
The morally relevant is the issue is really not genetics, it's marriage.
Yes.
The issue is, are you unwilling, if you have a theological view of marriage, this person was brought into my life, but you know what? If he's defective, I'm going to find somebody else.
Well, we do have this ideal, and I don't know if it's a theological ideal, but this ideal of love that it's unconditional, for better or worse. You get that you've got diabetes, cystic fibrosis. You have something. I love you. You've got that. That's what it means to be in that relationship, right? So marriage is not supposed to be about this kind of inquiry in a way, right? I mean, it seems that way. However, it is the case that when two young people are getting to the point where they're thinking about marriage, they do think about things like their families and histories, their histories, and sometimes that can include medical histories. Do they really, if there's a really known strand of something in the family, maybe they love the person, but they understand what it means to have a family, and they just don't feel up to the task of having a family that's going to be that, right? So you have those kinds of things in tension. You have your hand up.
Isn't it clear from lots of precedents who owns the fetus? I mean, she owns the fetus, right? I mean, isn't that well-established?
Well, by well-established and owned, I'm looking at my former professor at the SysBac deck, is that you're using the language of rights there in a particular way. And it's possible, I think we can all understand that it's possible for us to acknowledge that the person may have a legal right to something and also think that they're morally completely wrong in taking it, whatever that might be. So you have this, there's a sense in which the woman legally has, the woman in this case has the right to an abortion, right? And in this case, the genetic counselor withdrew from what she would otherwise think would be a right for her and a natural one to do the testing on the fetus. So I'm not sure what the moral relevance then of the what I think is an accurate assertion on your part.
When you were talking about the unconditional love,
right,
the analogous thing that you see in commercials, get a credit check on your spouse before you get married. I don't know if you've seen those commercials, but the guy supposedly got married and then he said found out that she had horrible credit and should have gone to a free credit.
Well, look, I mean, I'm going to make a quick comment thing that I have done. That is, okay, I know a couple really quite well. No real clear genetic problems in their family on their own. They get married. They have three boys. One of them severely genetically problematic, institutionalized. The other two almost so. And very similar kinds of things. Something is going on, right? And would they looking back on it now, you're not sure that they kind of give the impression that they were kind of tired of putting their hands in God, putting themselves in God's hands in that sense, and that they kept hoping that it wasn't. And had they had genetic testing before they conceived, not necessarily an issue about marriage necessarily, they might have done something other than do this and adopt and so on. But again, it calls us right back into the kind of questions we were facing yesterday about the meaning of a life, how we value life, particularly from theological perspective here, how we value what we think is essentially important and significant about being human, and whether any of these things that we're talking about now matter. They might be disappointments, they might be create suffering and so on, but ultimately, push comes to shove, that's where the where we stand. I don't know. Yeah.
I sort of want to go back to the credit check, because I'm sure you do this in your own ethics class. Sometimes in ethics classes, when you're dealing with a really sticky case, you take some less sticky things to shed some side light on it, and you say, well, A would be okay, B would probably be okay, C probably would be okay, but D, no. So what's the moral? So let's say you're getting pretty serious about a person, and you feel the person's a bit reticent and not as discursive and whatever as you wish. So you Google it. Okay. So maybe everybody in the room would say Googling him without his knowledge is okay. Okay, so that seems to turn out okay. No sex offenders, no this and that. Then you say, okay, now, because maybe you work at a bank and it's easy for you to do this surreptitiously, okay, now I'm going to run a credit check on it. So at this point, is everybody, in other words, you see, we're taking a number of easier steps. At what point does the slippery slope say, oh, well, that would definitely be wrong? So you've done the Google, that's fine. Now you've done the credit check, that's fine. Now you really upped the ante and decided to have his DNA tested. Now, what's the difference between the Google check and the credit check and the DNA testing? At what point is A okay, B okay, C definitely not okay? And what's the morally relevant distinction?
Because in the first two instances, the person that you are inquiring about is concealing knowledge from you that he has and you do not. In the genetic case, when there has been no genetic test done, there is no knowledge.
Well, he's concealing it from himself.
He's concealing it from himself. And my point about they shouldn't get married is if they can't decide whether or not they want to include this information in their decisions, then it doesn't sound like a very good match. But I don't think that there is an intent to deceive in the same instance.
So that would
A third step would be asking your prospective partner to be tested for sexually transmitted diseases, which is another one where there is no certainty. The person may not know whether or not he or she is carrying a sexually transmitted disease.
So, but that would be a morally relevant difference between
I
those
think
cases.
So, yes.
Morally relevant.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, on Friday we're going to do a case where you know a woman will take a strand of her hair and gives it to the potential partner, right, and says, if you like what you see, you know, give me a call. So where it's reached the stage where it's expected that the genetic disclosure is part of the whole ritual of moving towards marriage.
Well, also in the first two instances, it's public information. Mm-hmm. And the third one, it's personal, private information.
Well, mm-hmm. Not necessarily. I mean, somebody could be a serial murderer and not be caught. It wouldn't be public information.
I mean, if they've got a criminal record, it's public. And if they've got bad credit, I mean,
that's
in a sense, it's public.
You're checking public records. You're not checking.
Yeah, you don't need his consent to do that.
Well, getting back to consent and our people here,
right.
Steve consented to have intercourse with this woman. So he consented to give her genetic information. I mean,
that's true.
So if that's what he wanted to do, he took that risk. Now she's got the information. It's in her womb.
I don't think I'm lying that way.
Oh, male
that amounts.
What a male
well,
perspective.
You know, I mean, if he was so intent on hiding his status as to whether he was going to have hunting things or not, he should have thought of that before he decided to have it back. You know, it's
growing.
Like
there's
He used a condom and she saved the condom.
Oh, okay.
No,
she got pregnant.
She's got the baby.
No, I mean, she could have done that.
We're running out of time, but Kristen, I have a question for you.
I guess what's disturbing for me is that as you say, technology advances, yet we're moving back towards Plato's prediction or what he saw as the perfect world. So, you know, there's no answer theologically or morally, are we, about...
I don't know enough to know that yet. But my whole point is that this is a frustrating conversation, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting one. It's a stimulating one. We're perhaps getting bits and pieces of the puzzle and insight into here, but it's still a frustrating conversation. And my point is that I think we're going to need a lot of these things and patience with them before we can say whether we have something to say here. I think that these kinds of conversations, though, are exactly, you know, what we need. And my goal is to sell the importance of having frustrating conversations rather than coming up at the end and saying, here's what I think, and, you know.
Yeah, at this point, the individuals involved are the ones who are asking the questions. There will be a point very soon in which society asks the questions about, based on genetic information, which of our members of this society are to be breeders. And which are not.
Because as a society, we don't have the resources to take care of every genetically defective child.
Well that's another argument about the economics. And sometimes we're doing some other work in which the economics and the ethics seem to work well together. They actually kind of reinforce each other. In cases like this, the more you allow the economics to start factoring in here, the more grim the picture does look, in a way. You're right. Before we go, let me just ask, it's a survey-type question here. Based on all that you understand the case study to mean and the discussion we've had, if you were in the position of this counselor, would you have provided the services or not? Would you have withdrew yourself from this scenario, making perhaps a small but insignificant dent in terms of the outcomes, but nevertheless, perhaps sending a moral message to this person? How many of you would withdraw from how many of you would give her the services? How many of you still, based on this conversation, don't know what we would do? It's exactly, did you see that everyone's hands?
Yeah.
We're all over the map here.
What bothers me about this, I think, after we know everything there is to know,
there's not going to be a consensus.
Morally, very moral people will come to all sorts of different conclusions.
Because, you know, the counselor's goal in life is not to improve Mary as a person or improve Steve as a person. If they refuse it, Mary is probably going to get a divorce and dump Steve.
She's
probably going to dump him anyway, and
she's
not marry.
She's going to go to the next genetic counselor.
He's going to the next. If it does turn out that that he doesn't have the gene, then maybe they'll get married and have a child, and it will turn out to be a net gain in moral, global good or something. But that if she doesn't, there's no chance of a good outcome.
So you do the test despite her disclosure of the reasons she's doing it.
Yeah, because it's not my job to make her better.
The child could be clear, and Steve could have Huntington's.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's still that.
She doesn't have...
It's still a 50-50 shot.
100% information about the man she met.
It's still a 50-50 shot.
She only has half his DNA.
I just did a number on myself, and it switched me slightly. So first I thought, okay, so since I get home, I'm going to do this same thing in my class. And then I thought, okay, well, this is tricky. Then I did a little inversion. So I have four children. Three, fine, fourth, my youngest, my little girl, my tribe's child, 25, I'm married. So if Anna came to me, and she were this woman, and said, what do you think I should do, Dad? And the guy would want me to disclose it. I'd say, go for it, Anna, find out. Suddenly, as soon as it was my daughter, my fourth daughter, my final daughter, as soon as I played the game that way, I knew I was going to go with it. If I had did it in the abstract, or if I was a genetic counselor, or if it was an ethics class, I could say, oh, I could go this way, I could go that way. I said, this is my fourth and final daughter. I knew which way I was going.
So the theological punchline would be something like, who is my mother and my brother? Who's in Sisyphus? Here they are. Here they are. Everyone here that we're supposed to treat each other as though we were mothers, brothers, and sisters.
Because,
right?
You know, Mary couldn't be, you know, she can be a sympathetic character here. She's just trying to defend herself and defend her unborn child.
Well, it makes a difference to me. Does Mary really want to have this baby? Because then she has a right to know, am I going to be dealing with a child that has Huntington's? You know, I mean, you would want...
And for all we know, this guy's going to dump her as soon as he discovers she's pregnant
right,
without
yeah.
his baby.
But that doesn't... But I mean, if she intends to perhaps have this child or not have this child, if that's factoring into her thoughts, should I have an abortion because my child's going to have Huntington's, she has a right to that information. But if she's only had this conception and so that she can find out something about her boyfriend, then that seems...
That's what
like, well, what's the point if you're going to abort the baby anyway?
We don't know about any
we
of
don't
that.
Know what
all,
she's going to do
from
with
the,
this baby.
The standpoint, and we can create a, you know, a case in which we have variations
yeah.
on the case to answer, you know, to address those
but
questions.
But in the end, she has a right to the information.
Well, there is one,
well,
there is one
legally.
Legally.
Special case that is not quite as critical as this, and that would be the case of pharmacists who refuse to dispense birth control because, so they withdraw themselves from that interaction. And I think the genetic counselor is in a very similar situation.
Yeah, and I would think, though, that we wouldn't want to arrive at a conclusion that very bad things could happen, but it's no one's fault because everyone was just doing their job. It seems to me that you never stop being a human being. My doing medical ethics for so long, particularly in professional school context, I've come to the conclusion, this is a very simple theory, but it's a very simple formula, knowledge plus power equals responsibility, that whatever you think your job is, if you're a human being in a position to know and have power, then...
You have responsibility.
Yeah, even if you don't think it's your job or
first
you
do
think
no
that... It's to be opposed to your job to do something that you know you really need to do. And we could do a bunch of case studies to illustrate that real quick, but we don't even have that much time to do that. But you can't stop being a human being by just simply because you're a pharmacist or a genetic counselor or whatever it might be. It doesn't, you know, give you carte blanche freedom to play your moral cards everywhere, but...
A doctor that won't do an abortion.
Pardon?
A doctor who won't do an abortion.
Okay.
Yeah. It was a more serious version, in my mind, a more serious version than of a pharmacist story.
Or one who knows.
Yeah.
Right. It's just the same. It's the same. It's the other side of the coin.
I've kept you 15 minutes longer than I'm supposed to.
You shall pass.
Thank you.
You can charge higher tuition.
Yeah, I'll do that next time. They can double zero salary.